Greetings, bienvenidos a todo mi gente aquí in Washington, D.C. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, here on this Friday, June 26, 2015. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, along with Fernando Valseca as my co-host today. And today we're going to focus on debt, economic crises. It's been covered many times in many other publications and shows about the 2008 financial crisis in the U.S. However, little is talked about the Puerto Rican debt, or Puerto Rico's economic crisis as it stands today, and how a colony like Puerto Rico is affected by the recessions and economic collapse of the U.S. So with us today to talk about this is Ed Morales. He's an independent journalist, author of Living in Spanglish and the forthcoming Raza Matters. He is currently a lecturer at Columbia University Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. He's going to join us over the phone. He also has his own website, which is edmorales.net. That's edmorales.net. And from his website, you can find his most recent article, which is Puerto Rico's Dance with Debt. And you can also find it on Jacobin Magazine. And Ed Morales, can you hear us?
Yeah, I'm here. How are you doing?
Thank you very much, Ed, once again for being on the show with us. And once again, I want to remind everyone that your most recent article is entitled Puerto Rico's Dance with Debt. Debt being D-E-B-T, Puerto Rico is mired in debt and facing default, and U.S. colonialism is one of the main culprits. So that's the title of your most recent article. And so, as I said before, the 2008 financial crisis has been well documented in the U.S. and in various other, all sorts of publications and shows, whether it be radio, television, what have you. However, how does the current financial crisis in Puerto Rico compare or contrast to 2008?
Okay, well, there's some similarities in the storylines, and then there's big differences. First thing is that we have to understand that Puerto Rico has been in a recession since 2006, 2 years before the recession in the United States. And many analysts are, you know, wanting to categorize it as a depression now because of the high unemployment rate and the massive out-migration of people from the island because of lack of employment opportunities and the total stagnation of the economy. One of the similarities that the Puerto Rico recession has with the U.S., is it's kind of an analogous situation in the reasons for the crisis, like the crisis in the U.S., the recession of 2008, was in many ways caused by a bubble of investor speculation on bad loans, because when you have when you package bad loans into these what they call financial instruments, you're risking, but they have a higher payoff in the short term. So, as you know, like the U.S. financial crisis was in large part caused by the bundling of bad mortgages that were intentionally pushed on people who couldn't really afford them, to a lesser extent, you know, other things like credit card debt and things like that. And they were built into these toxic packages, which were traded by big investment houses. And then it became revealed as kind of a Ponzi scheme. And when they couldn't cover what their obligations were, then there was a crisis of liquidity. And so, as you know, the solution to the, you know, it really hasn't been resolved, but the Band-Aid that they gave to the recession was to bail out these large investment firms and banks because they were too big to fail, right? So mm-hmm. what's happening with Puerto Rico is that it's very different in the sense that Puerto Rico has been borrowing to cover a lot of its essential government expenses since the 1970s when there were recessions began in the United States because of the oil crisis. That's because Puerto Rico's economy has, you know, never been as dynamic or productive as the United States. So after the kind of the initial growth in the economy that was created after Operation Bootstrap, the recessions in the U.S. in the 70s, you know, affected Puerto Rico and the economy began to slump. So then they created this thing called the Section 936 of the Internal Revenue Service Code, and they allowed U.S. corporations to come to the United States and, you know, basically not pay any taxes on their profits. And so you wound up with a situation that when 936 was ended in 1996 and there was a 10-year grace period for that, that 10-year grace period ended in 2006. And so then you had really very little productive activity in Puerto Rico. Most of the light industries had failed, and some of the companies that came, like most notably pharmaceutical companies, they were also leaving, and a lot of that was due to the fact that the North American Free Trade Agreement was passed in the early 90s, and multinational corporations were allowed to go to all these other different countries where the wages were much lower, and Puerto Rico was no longer attractive for U.S. multinationals to set up business. So then without that, then the economy just has been gone into a free fall. And then, because the government was borrowing money to cover its expenses, it began to lose its credit rating. And when it started issuing bonds, a lot of the same vulture fund or hedge fund people that were speculating on the bad mortgages in the United States, and then after that, like the failing economy in Greece, they came and started buying up all this Puerto Rico debt. So right now it's $73 billion. And the gross domestic product of Puerto Rico is actually less than the debt that they owe. So that's kind of just living in a completely negative situation, and that's really what's caused it. So in a way, it's a similar kind of mechanism that's caused the Puerto Rico debt crisis in that, you know, it's really a lot of it is caused by desperation from the kind of the falling apart of the manufacturing sector and then, you know, the economy really being taken over by the financial sector. And then speculators, you know, but instead of speculating on a minority of people, you know, who were actually minorities in the United States, most of them, you know, they're actually speculating on a government that is being portrayed in the business press as like a consumer who uses credit cards to pay off their debt. So I hope that's not too confusing.
Well, it's not only a government, but it's a colonized government, to say the least, because we have to say it's a colony because other people refer to Puerto Rico as a commonwealth. And historically speaking, the term commonwealth was invented by the U.S. to avoid the fact that, yes, Puerto Rico is a colony of the U.S. Now, you just mentioned before that, you know, some of your reporting says that this financial crisis that Puerto Rico is going through now goes back into the 70s. And the impression I get from your article is that this actually, the financial structure of Puerto Rico historically actually predates NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. So I'm curious to know if you could give us an example of how Puerto Rico's financial structure historically also predates NAFTA as we know it and see it today?
All right. Well, it predates NAFTA in an important way, and it differs from NAFTA in an important way, too. Like, I mean, it's similar to NAFTA. It's kind of, I've called it a dry run, and it's kind of a dry run for NAFTA in the sense that, you know, when you look at what's, when you see what you see in Mexico and in other countries in Asia and Latin America now, is you see a penetration of all these U.S. multinationals. Like, you can drive around northern Mexico and see Burger Kings and McDonald's and things like that. That's kind of what happened, had been existing in Puerto Rico since the 50s and 60s, which was the result of this Operation Bootstrap, which they put into effect in the late 40s. And that basically happened because there was a strong nationalist movement that was growing that was based not only on nationalist feelings, but on a lot of labor strikes that were held in the 30s. And there was a lot of political violence. And so they got this sort of collaborationist guy, Luis Muñoz Marin, who was the first Puerto Rican governor elected, because before that they were all Anglos that were appointed by the U.S. he became the head of this new government, and the plan was that they were going to get rid of what was left of the subsistence agricultural economy and sort of force people off the land so that they wound up in the cities. This is very similar to, you know, what you hear about with NAFTA, you know. You get people who are kicked off of agricultural pieces of land, and they wind up in the cities, and then there's no jobs there, so they have to come to the United States. But in the case of Puerto Rico, it was really more intentional, and also because Puerto Ricans are American citizens, it's not a matter of illegal immigration. So when they developed this economy, basically what they wanted to do was create a small middle class in Puerto Rico that could take advantage of these new light industry manufacturing and American businesses that were going to cater to this to these consumers. And then the mostly poor people who came from the countryside, they were kind of they were sent to New York with very cheap plane fares. They were all just encouraged to go to New York and other major cities in the U.S. to make up the surplus labor force in large cities, and really, you know, have become a solidly entrenched part of the American working poor in major cities, mostly on the East Coast, but also in places like Chicago and Cleveland. So in Puerto Rico, you had this sort of manufactured middle class that actually enjoyed, you know, a moment of you know, where it just seemed like it was viable. It became sort of like the what they call the showcase of the Caribbean, and this is important because, you know, in 1959 there was a Cuban Revolution, and so for propaganda purposes, the U.S. wanted to show off Puerto Rico as a Caribbean island that was imbued with a dose of capitalism, and the people, you know, had a higher standard of living and more of a consumer lifestyle than revolutionary Cuba. So, the difference between what happened in Puerto Rico is that they were working on these old import substitution models, which encouraged local manufacturing and development of economy and did not stress exports as much as, you know, the free trade era does. And they actually, you know, they didn't try to destroy labor unions. They allowed labor unions to exist. So in Puerto Rico, what you had was, it's very much like the situation in Puerto Rico in general. You didn't really have them tied to the minimum wage laws in the United States, but you had a minimum wage that was just sort of slightly below the U.S. minimum wage. You had labor unions that were allowed to flourish and protect the interests of workers both in the private sector and in the government sector. And you know, but that was pretty much, like I said, that model fell apart after NAFTA, you know, and, you know, the big difference between NAFTA, as we know, is that NAFTA is not about tolerating unions, it's not about protecting the environment, it's not about establishing something close to a minimum wage. So basically NAFTA, you know, was a dry run in Puerto Rico in the sense that you had multinationals coming in and hiring what they considered to be like a foreign labor force, speaking a strange language like Spanish, and people who were not part of the North American Anglo, cultural experience. And so they kind of, it was a dry run in that way. U.S. Multinationals realized that they could run these businesses and create consumers among people who were not from the United States. But when NAFTA came, you know, they abandoned all the protections that existed in Puerto Rico. And of course, then the labor became much more unattractive in Puerto Rico as a result of that as well. Because if you could go to Mexico and pay people a fraction of what they made in Puerto Rico, and also, you know, did not have the protection of labor unions and, you know, union busting galore and just, you know, chaos and lack of environmental regulation, then, you know, you can see why multinationals, you know, no longer found Puerto Rico a viable place.
It's sort of an argument that we've made here on the show with regards to NAFTA, that ultimately the free movement of capital undermines democracy, and Puerto Rico is just one example of that. Sure. Fernando, you had a question?
Yeah, Ed, how can the Puerto Rican economy be changed and adapted to be self-sufficient and independent? Is backtracking the economy to its agricultural and touristic principles the correct route, restructuring Puerto Rico's economy?
Well, you know, basing an economy on agriculture right now has been very risky since the general devaluation of what's called commodities, you know, on the exchange market. Like, commodities are all kind of agricultural products. Mm. And, you know, that was one of the things that the multinational interests did, was they devalued commodities by undercutting prices. And part of that, too, was protecting the American, you know, American farmers have these huge subsidies, so that foreign farmers, it's very hard to compete with them. So, you know, right now, a lot of, you know, what's proposed a lot for Puerto Rico, which really has been the case for, you know, around, you know, like 20 years or so, is just trying to adapt to this newer kind of economic ideas, like, you know, niche marketing and, you know, growing something like kale or something that, you know, you can sell in Whole Foods or something, you know, that there was a kind of a more of expensive product than, you know, than just, you know, sugar or coffee or something like that. And, tourism is part of it. You know, I mean, there's a lot of talk about, you know, people coming up with new kinds of ideas. But the problem is that, right now, you know, the government has $72 billion in debt, and so where do you start from is what I'm saying. You know, right now, if Puerto Rico becomes independent, the debt is still not going to be forgiven, and so it's really a huge obstacle to start out with. You know, like I've suggested, you know, I have this, like, crazy idea that, you know, there's not politically tenable, but I feel is, like, the only really human rights way to look at it. And who knows, maybe there's so much happening in the world today with people really waking up to centuries of injustice, you know, lately. But and there are some movements towards this, like in the English-speaking Caribbean, and of course among the African-American community. And what I'm talking about is petitioning for some form of reparations. I think that, you know, it's a politically untenable idea, but I really think that... it's something that maybe if people keep pushing and throwing against the wall, maybe it'll stick. I mean, especially now that there's so much of a climate of the United States beginning to wake up to the atrocities it's committed over, you know, centuries. You know, the idea of starting out this new independent country with this seed money based on a significant reparations, you know, and I realize it's a really a pie-in-the-sky idea because of the tightness of the economy now, but, I mean, there has to be some movement towards wealth redistribution at some point, because really the economic models that we have in place worldwide don't really, the only thing they work for is to create more inequality and accumulation of wealth among a smaller amount of people. So,
and with that,
you know, so eventually that's going to, you know, that stuff is going to hit the fan. You know, sure. I just hope that it happens in my lifetime. I don't know.
Now, from what I got from your article, Puerto Rico's Dance with Debt, the money that is being made in Puerto Rico by U.S. corporations is not staying in Puerto Rico. In other words, the money is not benefiting Puerto Rico or its citizens, but going directly back to the U.S. economy. Do you see a way, or is there a way, of keeping more of that money in Puerto Rico?
Well, I mean, you know, it again, you know, there's people that can set up, you know, their micro businesses and stuff, but I mean, it's really kind of a small scale retention of profits, and then a lot of times that is based on getting loans from banks, you know, whose fortunes are ultimately tied to the U.S. banking system. So, you know, I think it's a long road to hoe, you know, to actually create a viable economy out of, you know, essentially a bunch of niche markets, you know, when the banking system really is, controlling, and we, you know, we cannot guarantee that these businesses are going to survive, and then once they don't survive, then the banks then move in and collect that. I mean, I had a meeting with some lawyers a couple of years ago, and they told me that this unsubstantiated rumor about that, you know, the Walmart, actually, you know, there's more Walmarts in Puerto Rico, and I have the figures, but there's a really good report in the Center of Investigative Journalism that Puerto Rico runs, where I think there's more Walmarts per square mile in Puerto Rico than anywhere in the world or something like that. And so they, you know, I've heard that they actually just, you know, they drive these bags of cash to the airport and fly them out every night. And the thing about, so when Section 936 is in effect, even though there were no taxes, there was a provision that the corporations had to keep the money in Puerto Rican banks for 2 years before it could be repatriated. So at least that money stayed in the economy. So that's another thing that happened with the end of 936. You know, now there's no provision for corporations to keep the money on the island for any period of time.
One thing that caught my attention in your article was Puerto Rico's perception, at least economically portrayed during the Cold War, when compared to Cuba. Now, this sort of stopped me in my tracks when you brought this part up in your story, because hypothetically, if the Cuban Revolution hadn't happened, and if there were to have been an acquiescent government in Cuba, similar to Puerto Rico, we could have easily put Cuba's name in place of Puerto Rico on your article, if that were to happen generations ago. So, to go back to what I just said, during the Cold War, how was Puerto Rico's economy portrayed when compared to Cuba back in the day?
Well, yeah, like I said, I mean, it was publicized as the showcase of the Caribbean, and the propagandistic purpose behind that. You know, I would say though that, you know, the thing is that, I mean, I don't think that Cuba, if there was never a Cuban Revolution, I mean, I don't think they would have tried to create what they did in Puerto Rico and Cuba, because there would be no need to, and that it would continue to be this sort of Wild West kind of place that was filled with corruption the way that Cuba was. But one thing that is true is that if there was no Cuban Revolution, then Puerto Rico would probably be much poorer than it is today. And, you know, in a way, like Puerto Rico and Cuba, in terms of consumer economy, kind of flip-flop roles, you know, because earlier in the century, Puerto Rico was a very poor place in the Caribbean, and Cuba was, you know, a dynamic economy in a capitalist sense. And so, you know, and then since then, now, you know, we know that the reason why, you know, I mean, there are many reasons why the Cuban economy is not a consumer economy. Some of them are positive. In other ways, though, you know, the lack of access to basic goods in Cuba is a detriment to people there. But, you know, we can argue about why that's true. But, yeah, they kind of switched roles as a result of the revolution. It's because the U.S. sort of created this pseudo-capitalist consumer economy that really the problem is, though, the other thing I haven't mentioned is that it's really kind of like a wholly owned subsidiary of the U.S. economy. They cannot make really decisions for themselves. The Jones Act provides that trading ships that come into the ports, you know, have to be under a U.S. flag, and Puerto Rico is not free to make trade agreements with other countries. So Puerto Rico is not in control of its economy, and really any development of the Puerto Rican economy is, you know, at the whim of the United States, you know, the same way all political decisions are, because, you know, if there was a plebiscite today and 95% of the people voted for statehood, it's not binding, and so it would have to be approved by Congress. And would seem to me very unlikely.
It's quite funny that you just mentioned statehood, because we just happen to be talking to you from Washington, D.C., which has had its own issues with dealing with statehood as well. So, once again, we're speaking with Ed Morales, an independent journalist. His latest article can be found on his website, edmorales.net, which is entitled Puerto Rico's Dance with Debt. We're going to take a short break right here. We're going to continue more with Ed Morales, but for now we're going to take a short break. This is the Latino Media Collective. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Once again, we're speaking with Ed Morales, independent journalist, the author of Living in Spanglish. His most recent article can be found on his website, which is edmorales.net, entitled Puerto Rico's Dance with Debt. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez along with Fernando Valseca. And before we continue, we want to remind everyone that you can also listen and download some of our previous episodes of the Latino Media Collective. If you go to wpfwfm.org, that's wpfwfm.org. Also, we want to take this opportunity to open up the phone lines if anyone has a question or comment to Ed Morales regarding Puerto Rican's economic crisis. You can give us a call at 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. So, Ed, are you still there with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
So, we just happened to hit in passing towards the end of the first half about statehood, because here in D.C., we have this issue with statehood as well, where even though, you know, D.C. is just as much a part, physically part of the United States as anywhere else, there is no representation here as far as citizens of Washington, D.C., as far as getting representation. There are license plates that say taxation without representation. And in addition to that, there's also economic limitations of Washington, D.C. They don't have complete financial control over the economic control over their financial destiny. They have to have their budget, whatever it may be, approved by Congress and the House, and I'm pretty sure you know all this, and I'm pretty sure the same could be said of Puerto Rico's economic direction. So because it is a colony, tell us, for people who may not know, what are the limitations imposed on Puerto Rico's economy? You've mentioned in passing already Section 926, and I just want to know if there are other examples other than 926 that you would like to give people with regards to Puerto Rico's economic limitations.
Section 936 is actually not, I mean, it's not in effect anymore. It was phased out in 2006. And it was actually kind of an aid to the economy and not a limitation, because even though it allowed U.S. multinationals to operate in Puerto Rico without paying federal taxes, they did provide a certain level of employment and gave Puerto Rico a feeling that there was economic activity in some way. The other limitations are ones I described, like the fact that Puerto Rico cannot enter into trade agreements with other countries, and they cannot accept ships in their ports that are flying flags other than the United States. Politically, you know, Puerto Rico has very little power to engage with other countries in the rest of the world, because it doesn't have national sovereignty. Many people have criticized or been upset, like most notably the rapper Residente from Calle 13 has long complained, you know, one of the reasons he wants independence of Puerto Rico is because Puerto Rico really is not able to engage with its brother and sister countries in Latin America in an effective way. And there's really an effect from that, in the sense that the rest of Latin America, you know, doesn't really know a lot about Puerto Rico, and Puerto Ricans themselves don't easily travel to the rest of Latin America. And it kind of adds to what is called insularismo, which is the insular character of Puerto Rican economy, life, politics, which means that, since it's a kind of an isolated island at the end of the Greater Antilles, you know, if you go east, mm-hmm. next stop is Africa. And there's, it's a two-hour flight south to Caracas, and then there's Dominican Republic.
Ed Morales.
Next door.
Ed Morales, looks like we have a caller on the line with us. Caller, can you hear us?
Yes.
Do you have a question or a comment for Ed Morales regarding Puerto Rico's debt?
Yes, I do. And based on the conversation you have now, and thanks for bringing this conversation up, and a lot of Americans don't know, including myself, what really is happening in Puerto Rico. I have tried to find out. And I know about an independent movement that was going on in Puerto Rico. I know about a statehood movement. As a matter of fact, I'm a member of the statehood party here in D.C. But it appears as one thing that's not being fully talked about is the fact that the same powers that were colonial powers some 200-300 years ago are the capitalist countries now, and they are driven, capitalism is driven outside of this country by imperialism, which encompasses Puerto Rico and enslavement of their people. And imperialism means that when you go outside of your country and you control your resources and the labor power and the markets of another country. And so without a fully understanding of that, we will see that there's a perpetuation of the kind of exploitation and abuse that the Puerto Ricans and other people around the world who are under the influence of colonial powers have today, whether it is their own people or some foreign folks. Thank you for the show, and thank you, sir. Your information has been overwhelming. Thank you, Spock.
Thank you very much, caller. So, Ed Morales, you want to respond?
Heavy, man, you know, trying to chill here, you know. No, but I'm glad, you know, the brother, you know, got informed somehow.
So, yeah. One thing, go on ahead.
I'm done, yeah. Next question.
One of the things that, you know, one of the things that mentioned in your article that also brought my attention is that, yes, you know, the caller's right in everything that he just mentioned about historical colonial power, whether it be the U.S. or elsewhere, but also based on your article, not all the ills of Puerto Rico's economy can solely be blamed on the U.S. You know, there's not, you know, colonialism without a little bit of acquiescence. So can you tell us about the complicity of certain sectors of Puerto Rican society? I know that there's a quote that from a Professor Quiñones, correct me if I'm wrong, that really caught my attention as well.
Yeah, Argeo Quiñones. I actually was hanging out with him yesterday in San Juan. Yeah, well, you know, what he was talking about is he's very strong in this idea. You know, he's really interested. I mean, he's very motivated by not falling in line with kind of knee-jerk leftist arguments that completely blame the U.S. as if Puerto Rico was just, you know, had... They're powerless and, you know, was just, you know, tied up in a room and, you know. So what he's saying is that it's much like in the rest of Latin America, you know, there are collaborators with multinational capital that aid these processes. So what he's talking about, in Puerto Rico, it's a little different because it's not an oligarchy like a lot of countries in Latin America. It's basically, it has a very U.S.-like system of government. So it's actually more similar to the corruption in Congress, you know, which involves a revolving door between law firms, political office, and lobbying firms. And so a lot of the politicians in Puerto Rico at the high level are really involved in that. The current, you know, the previous statehood governor, Luis Fortuño, who, you know, was very destructive, in my opinion, to the fortunes of Puerto Rico. You know, he doesn't live in Puerto Rico anymore. He's now, you know, in this high-powered Washington law firm, which I haven't checked, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's tied to K Street. And, you know, and also the people in government, whether they are, you know, engaged in something that's really just about profiting themselves, you know, which is what a lot of people in the banking industry and the legal industry are about in Puerto Rico. I mean, even if you don't think, even if you think that they have the best intention, you know, the most, I mean, the argument that's going on now is to restructure the debt and to allow Puerto Rico to declare bankruptcy because since it's not a state in the union, it's not given bankruptcy protection. So even if that is achieved, you know, which is something that's being pushed by the Commonwealth Party, you know, which is moderate compared to the right-wing statehood party that we previously had. And not all statehood governors are right-wing, but the last bunch was particularly, you know, like almost like a phalange, in my opinion. Falange de España, ¿se entiende? The current government, you know, is more moderate, but, you know, if they succeed and get bankruptcy protection for Puerto Rico or debt restructuring, this is just going to involve further austerity. You know, it's just going to involve more cuts to government jobs, the more shrinking of government expenditures, and that is, you know, that just doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't really work in the United States either. but it's even worse in, you know, what are known as peripheral economies like Puerto Rico, and that's in a way that what's similar between Puerto Rico and Greece, which also has gone through a lot of economic problems. So even the moderate position is, in a way, collaborating with the goals of multinational capital because it's giving them what they want. You know, it's saying, all right, even if you're going to let us pay less, we're still going to pay this high price. And as, you know, in my article in Jacobin, I noted that the they just passed an increase in the sales tax to 11.25%, you know, which is higher than any sales tax in the union. And this is like on an island, you know, that has a per capita income of like $15,700, you know, which is way below any state in the union. So that's really draining from the pockets of, you know, essentially the working poor or people who are not even in the employment market here in Puerto Rico. So it's I would say it's pretty severe austerity. And so, you know, whether it can be, you know, this collaboration can be, like I said, on the pernicious end, people actively just seeking to enrich themselves at the expense of the poor, but and then even people who are moderate, who think that they are trying to promote a just solution, you know, are also enforcing the priorities of multinational capital, severe austerity.
Ed, looking forward a little bit, how do you see the future of Puerto Rico? Like Cuba's, where revolution will break loose and the government becomes communist and economic sanctions are then set into place and so on? Or do you see a Puerto Rico that restructures their economy to be self-sufficient and becomes independent from the United States?
Well, you know, I think, you know, that in the Caribbean, at least, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, you still have, I mean, this thing about armed revolution is really, you know, and I'm not happy to say this, but it seems to be like kind of part of the past. You know, I mean, people make fun of the FARC in Colombia because they're, you know, they're, it's such an old model. I don't really see the potential for armed revolution in Puerto Rico. So the only way that there's going to be a drastic, you know, shift towards something like communism is probably going to be through an armed revolution. The, you know, as far as, you know, here's the thing, right? There's a lot of people, a lot of well-meaning people who are economists, who really care. You know, they're in the academic sector. They advise politicians on the island who come up with these really, you know, thoughtful ideas about where to begin with salvaging the economy. And a lot of them feel that, the bankruptcy protection is something of a start, but that bankruptcy protection, and it, you know, remains to be seen whether the Commonwealth Party has this kind of commitment, but, you know, there must be some way to use the liquidity that would be gained by this buying time with the debt to, you know, directly, it's the same kind of thing, you know, that Democrats and Obama, you know, want to propose, which is really commit to infrastructure rebuilding. You know, the Puerto Rico infrastructure is in really bad shape. The roads are terrible. Finding new ways to produce electricity, because all of the electricity that's produced in Puerto Rico is dependent on oil imports, because all the electricity is generated by oil.
You know,
so, you know, these kind of plans have to be put in place, you know, rather than, I don't know, just maintaining the status quo and, you know, keeping these overbloated bureaucracies, you know, going. I mean, there has to be some kind of streamlining, and, you know, that would affect real change and opportunity for economic growth. But, you know, given that economic growth is so difficult to attain, right, even in the most developed countries, you know, this is what the problem is. You know, I mean, it's and everybody is so tied together now because of globalization, and there's no tariff protection or anything like that. It's a very difficult task. I mean, I think that in a sense, you know, something has to be done to face Puerto Rico's immediate problems, but the larger problem is just the continuation of growth of inequality worldwide, you know, by the systems that we're currently operating under. That really has to be the, you know, the priority.
You know, and it's, you know, there are You know, here we are talking amongst ourselves as rational people, because by no means that rational people would want to see an armed conflict, no matter who starts it, because at the end of the day, it's only innocent lives that will be the victims of armed conflicts. But, you know, the U.S., you know, as a whole has shown that they are more than capable of using force. And I'm not talking about historical things that happened 4 or 5 generations ago in Puerto Rico. I mean, we could just look in very, very recent times, over the last 10, 15 years in Puerto Rico. The first thing that comes up to mind when we just mentioned armed conflict, and correct me if I'm wrong, was the assassination several years ago of Filiberto Ojeda Rios. I hope I'm saying his name right, because I always...
Sure, no, that's
confusing,
right.
You know, because that's the first thing that comes up to mind when with armed conflicts, or when some sort of independence movement from Puerto Rico, because we've also covered here on the show several times in the past a student-led movement for Puerto Rican independence, you know, mm-hmm. and this developed, you know, early part of the 2000s. I don't know if it still has the same movement or same rhythm or same momentum as a few years ago, but, you know, can you elaborate on that bit? I mean, what has happened to the student-led movement that took place some time ago in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question because, yeah, there was a big student movement in 2010 and 2011 that was provoked by the Scott Walker-like tactics of Governor Fortuna, which was, you know, laying off massive numbers of government employees, and government is the largest employee in the island, trying to take away the right of unions to negotiate contracts and otherwise suppressing unions. And so both the labor sector and the student movement, and also raising things like raising tuition fees to an amount that was essentially unaffordable by middle-class or low-middle-class students. So the student movement was very strongly organized. And in fact, they used kind of the same kind of, what do they call it, horizontalist tactics that were actually later employed in Occupy Wall Street. They think they had a lot of influence for what was happening in Spain. And it was a very strong movement. I interviewed several of them when I wrote a piece for The Nation in 2011 about the abuses of the Puerto Rico police, which resulted, I mean, my article didn't result in it, but... the abuses of the police resulted in a consent decree imposed by the Department of Justice, which means that they, you know, they were sort of in charge of overseeing this restructuring and reform of the police department, because there were a lot of abuses with pepper spray and deadly chokeholds that were used. And there was a lot of just... impunity, you know, impunity of beating and spraying people during those incidents, much worse, really, than what you saw in Occupy Wall Street. so, yeah, it was a strong movement, but, you know, I mean, what happens is, look, people move on. A lot of the students have graduated. I think some of them actually were probably placed under surveillance and are, you know, really low-key as a result of that. But there were significant student demonstrations earlier in the year, I forget whether it was April or May, about another proposed increase in tuition fees, which, you know, is being done by the, you know, the moderate Commonwealth governor, and they're still trying to push that. And so I imagine there's going to be more protests around that.
Ed Morales.
Yeah.
So we have about 3 minutes left, so I want to give Fernando the last question before we let you go.
Yeah, and Morales, like we had said, we don't know much about, you know, Puerto Ricans in the news or in, you know, CNN networks, ABC, NBC, all these. What do the Puerto Ricans want? Do you think that they would want to be independent from the U.S., or do you think that they look at the U.S. as a way of bettering their economy, strengthening their economy?
Well, I think that the stated movement has grown more powerful because things have gotten worse, and people, you know, a lot of people tend to go to the right, and, you know, it's already kind of a conservative country in a sense, you know, with the Catholicism and then, right, you know, stuff like that. So That's part of it, but also because, you know, the Commonwealth itself, the status is being revealed as, you know, increasingly untenable or, you know, not valid, largely because of the end of 936 and, you know, the abandonment of all these U.S. Corporations from Puerto Rico. And so what people see is, you know, since 2006, the recession, and that has happened under Commonwealth status. So there is, you know, a move towards statehood. Now, you know, there's not a lot of movement towards independence. And, you know, there's that book by Nelson Dennis that came out on Nation Books recently, which described all of the repressive tactics that the U.S. government used against independence movement leaders, you know, including, you know, the kinds of surveillance, you know, that we talk about now, you know, in the Snowden era. You know, it wasn't done with the high-tech digital equipment, but, you know, there's a famous case of how in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, anyone who had any kind of affiliation with even just, like, you know, culture or, you know, who came into contact, you know, cultural institutions that came into contact with people who were sort of on the left, they created an FBI file on them. So there is so much... there was so much repression of the independence position that I don't really think that it's been a fair and free process about whether people want to choose independence or not. I mean, to be for independence in Puerto Rico, you know, became almost tantamount to, you know, being a member of a communist or socialist party in the United States. And so how many people are going to, you know, vote for Bernie Sanders if he, you know, runs on a socialist line? You know, it's the same thing, even though he does represent probably the needs of the majority of people, and even though, you know, trying a fair independence, you know, like I said, with substantial reparations as seed money, I think would be, you know, the best thing to happen for Puerto Rico.
We've been speaking with Ed Morales. He's an independent journalist, also the author of Living in Spanglish. He has his own website, which is edmorales.net. That's edmorales.net. And on his website, you can read his most recent article, which is Puerto Rico's Dance with Debt. Once again, that's edmorales.net. Ed, thank you very much for being on the show with us. I know you mentioned in passing Calle 13. I know that I think you've done something on them on your website as well. So it's not just hard news, but there's a lot of fun stuff and interesting stimulating work on edmorales.net. So, Ed, thank you very much once again for being on the show with us, and we hope to have you again sometime in the future.
Okay, shout out to everybody out there in D.C. who might remember me or not, or even if you don't remember me.
We do. So, again, thank you very much, Ed, for being on the show. And with that said, that is it for today's show. Stay tuned now for the afternoon news, followed by Jade Winter Nightwolf. Indigenous voices heard back to back and heard nowhere else other than WPFW. So for Fernando Valseca, I'm Oscar Fernandez. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. That is it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
This is WPFW News. I'm Askia Muhammad. Here's some headlines at the 2 o'clock hour. The Supreme Court declared today that same-sex couples have a right to marry anywhere in the United States. Gay and lesbian couples already can marry in 36 states and the District of Columbia. The court's 5-4 ruling means that the remaining 14 states in the South and the Midwest will have to stop enforcing their bans on same-sex marriage. The outcome is the culmination of two decades of Supreme Court litigation over marriage and gay rights generally. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the majority opinion just as he did in the court's previous three major gay rights cases dating back to 1996. This came on the anniversary of two of those earlier decisions. Quote, "No union is more profound than marriage," Kennedy wrote, joined by the court's four more liberal justices. People are gathered by the thousands in Charleston, South Carolina at this hour to mourn a racial attack that left 9 African Americans dead, killed by a gunman who made racist comments. A line of people waited for hours, stretching more than 6 blocks to enter the College of Charleston's TD Arena for the funeral of the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, also a state senator, one of the victims of the attack at Emmanuel AME Church. Thousands came to mourn Pinckney, who was shot to death during a Bible class on June 17th at the historic African American church. Above the crowd loomed a statue of John C. Calhoun, the 7th president of the United States and a staunch defender of slavery. The 44th president of the United States, Barack Obama, is scheduled to give the eulogy for Pinckney. A predominantly black church has been targeted with arson in Charlotte, North Carolina. Part of the Briar Creek Road Baptist Church burned down after it was deliberately torched on Wednesday. Investigators are looking into the blaze as a possible hate crime. An attacker stormed an American-owned industrial chemical plant near Lyon, France today, decapitated one person and tried unsuccessfully to blow up the factory in what the French authorities said was a terrorist attack. The suspect entered the plant in a vehicle that may have been driven by an accomplice, President François Hollande said, and tried to use gas canisters to set off a bigger explosion. Hollande did not say whether the accomplice was detained. In addition, two people opened fire at beachgoers at a hotel in Tunisia today, killing at least 27 people, officials said. The attack took place at the Hotel Imperial Marhaba in Sousse, a popular resort town on the northeast coast of Africa. Security forces killed one of the attackers, while the second attacker fled and remains at large. This according to the country's interior ministry. Mostly cloudy with isolated storms this afternoon. Cloudy with scattered showers tonight, lows in the 70s. Currently it's cloudy and 78 degrees. Stay tuned for the Night Wolf Show with Jay Winter Night Wolf. And coming up from 3 p.m. until 5 p.m., the press conference announcement by Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Justice or Else 20th anniversary commemoration of the Million Man March, which took place at Metropolitan AME Church on Wednesday. I'm Askia Muhammad. Thank you for listening to WPFW Washington.